Oscar was the most generous of men, and not only with money and gifts. He gave of his time, his wit, his wise criticism, and of his encouragement and praise, which were at times mere flattery. Lord Alfred Douglas was always convinced, or claimed, that it was Oscar who had pursued and seduced him. But that is not how I saw it. Oscar's manner towards young Bosie was his manner to all young, beautiful, talented men, and Bosie did have some talent. Oscar delighted in such young aspirants. He sang their praises, he urged them on to higher achievement. He tempted them with new and daring modes of thought. Such a manner may be misunderstood as a different form of temptation, as wooing. But there is no doubt Oscar fell under the young lordship's spell. I remember he wrote to me in the summer of 1892 a letter in which he describes the boy as quite like a narcissus. He lies like a hyacinth on the sofa, and I worship him. Oscar knew how I'd smile at that. But the events to be recounted in the passage you are about to hear took place more than 2 years after that summer idyll, and I've no doubt that behind Oscar's wit and casual seduction, behind his daring pose, there was a genuine hunger for a deeper, dangerous passion. One with the power to break a heart. He found that indeed.
3 years ago is a long time for you to go back. But we who live in prison, and in whose lives there is no event but sorrow, have to measure time by throbs of pain and the record of bitter moments. We have nothing else to think of. Suffering, curious as it may sound to you, is the means by which we exist, because it is the only means by which we become conscious of existing. And the remembrance of suffering in the past is necessary to us as the warrant, the evidence of our continued identity. Had our life together been as the world fancied it to be, one simply of pleasure, profligacy, and laughter, I would not be able to recall a single passage in it. It is because it was full of moments and days, tragic, bitter, sinister in their warnings, that I can see or hear each separate incident in its detail, can indeed see or hear little else. October 1894. I was trying to finish my last play at Worthing. You insisted on being taken to the Grand Hotel at Brighton. The night we arrive, you fall ill with that dreadful low fever that is foolishly called the influenza. I need not remind you how I waited on you and tended you, not merely with every luxury of fruit, flowers, presents, books, and the like that money can procure, but with that affection, tenderness, and love that, whatever you may think, is not to be procured for money. I got special grapes from London for you, as you did not care for those the hotel supplied. Invented things to please you, remained either with you or in the room next to yours, sat with you every evening to quiet or amuse you. After 4 or 5 days you recover, and I take lodgings in order to try and finish my play. You, of course, accompany me. The morning after the day on which we were installed, I feel extremely ill. You have to go to London on business, but promise to return in the afternoon. In London, you meet a friend, and do not come back to Brighton till late the next day, by which time I am in a terrible fever, and the doctor finds I have caught the influenza from you. Nothing could have been more uncomfortable for anyone ill than the lodgings turn out to be. My sitting room is on the first floor, my bedroom on the third. There is no manservant to wait on one. Not even anyone to send out on a message, or to get what the doctor orders. But you are there. I feel no alarm. The next 2 days, you leave me entirely alone, without care, without attendance, without anything. It was not a question of grapes, flowers, and charming gifts. It was a question of mere necessaries. I could not even get the milk the doctor had ordered for me. Lemonade was pronounced an impossibility, and when I begged you to procure me a book at the bookseller's, or if they had not got whatever I had fixed on, to choose something else, you never even take the trouble to go there. All the while you are, of course, living at my expense, driving about, dining at the Grand Hotel, and indeed only appearing in my room for money. On Saturday night, you having left me completely unattended and alone since the morning, I asked you to come back after dinner and sit with me for a little. With irritable voice and ungracious manner, you promised to do so. I wait till 11 o'clock, and you never appear. I then left a note for you in your room, just reminding you of the promise you had made me, and how you had kept it. At 3 o'clock in the morning, unable to sleep and tortured with thirst, I made my way in the dark and cold down to the sitting room, in the hopes of finding some water there. I found you. You fell on me with every hideous word an intemperate mood and undisciplined and untutored nature could suggest. By the terrible alchemy of egotism, you converted your remorse into rage. You accused me of selfishness in expecting you to be with me when I was ill, of standing between you and your amusements, of trying to deprive you of your pleasures. You told me that you had come back at midnight simply in order to change your dress clothes and go out again to where you hoped new pleasures were waiting for you, but that by leaving for you a letter in which I had reminded you that you had neglected me the whole day and the whole evening, I had really robbed you of your desire for more enjoyments and diminished your capacity for fresh delights. I went back upstairs in disgust and remained sleepless till dawn. At 11 o'clock you came into my room. I waited naturally to hear what excuses you had to make, and in what way you were going to ask for the forgiveness that you knew in your heart was invariably waiting for you, no matter what you did. Your absolute trust that I would always forgive you, being the thing in you that I always really liked the best. Perhaps the best thing in you to like. So far from doing that, you began to repeat the same scene with renewed emphasis and more violent assertion. I told you at length to leave the room. You pretended to do so, but when I lifted up my head from the pillow, you were still there. And with brutality of laughter and hysteria of rage, you moved suddenly towards me. A sense of horror came over me, for what exact reason I could not make out. But I got out of my bed at once, and barefooted and just as I was, made my way down the 2 flights of stairs to the sitting room, which I did not leave till the owner of the lodgings had assured me that you had left my bedroom. After an hour you returned, silently, for money, took what you could find on the dressing table and mantelpiece, and left the house with your luggage. Is it necessary for me to state that I saw clearly that it would be a dishonour to myself to continue even an acquaintance with such a one as you had showed yourself to be, that I recognised that the ultimate moment had come? Ill as I was, I felt at ease. The fact that the separation was irrevocable gave me peace. By Tuesday the fever had left me. Wednesday was my birthday. Amongst the telegrams and communications on my table was a letter in your handwriting. I opened it with a sense of sadness over me. I knew that the time had gone by when a pretty phrase, an expression of affection, a word of sorrow, would make me take you back. But I was entirely deceived. I had underrated you. The letter you sent to me on my birthday was an elaborate repetition of the 2 scenes set cunningly and carefully down in black and white. You mocked me with common jests. Your one satisfaction in the whole affair was, you said, that you retired to the Grand Hotel and entered your luncheon to my account before you left for town. You congratulated me on my prudence in leaving my sick bed on my sudden flight downstairs. It was an ugly moment for you, you said. Uglier than you imagine. Ah, I felt it but too well. What it had really meant, I did not know. Whether you had with you the pistol you had bought to try and frighten your father with, and that, thinking it to be unloaded, you had once fired off in a public restaurant in my company, whether your hand was moving towards a common dinner knife that by chance was lying on the table between us, Whether you had thought of some specially personal insult or attack, even, I could not tell. I do not know to the present moment. All I know is that a feeling of utter horror had come over me, and that I had felt that unless I left the room at once, you would have done or tried to do something that would have been, even to you, a source of lifelong shame. It was not the first time I have been obliged to save you from yourself. You concluded your letter by saying, "When you are not on your pedestal, you are not interesting. The next time you are ill, I will go away at once." What an entire lack of imagination! How callous! How common! How often have those words come back to me in the wretched solitary cell of the various prisons I have been sent to? I settled with myself to write to your father to state that I determined never, under any circumstances, to allow you to enter my house, to talk to me, walk with me, or anywhere and at any time to be my companion at all. On Friday morning, as I was sitting at breakfast, I happened to open the newspaper and saw in it that your elder brother had been found dead in a ditch, with his gun lying discharged beside him. The horror of the circumstances, now known to have been an accident, but then stained with a darker suggestion. The pathos of the sudden death of one so loved by all who knew him. My idea of what your own sorrow would or should be. My consciousness of the misery awaiting your mother at the loss of one who, as she told me once herself, had never caused her to shed a single tear. Out of the confluence of these thoughts and emotions came infinite pity for you and your family. I telegraphed to you my deepest sympathy, and in the letter that followed, invited you to come to my house as soon as you were able. On your return to town, you came at once to me, very sweetly and very simply, in your suit of woe, and with your eyes dim with tears. You sought my consolation and help as a child might seek it. I opened to you my house, my home, my heart. I made your sorrow mine also, that you might have help in bearing it. Your grief, which was real, seemed to me to bring you nearer to me. The flowers you took from me to put on your brother's grave were to be a symbol not merely of the beauty of his life, but of the beauty that in all lives lies dormant and may be brought to light. The gods are strange. It is not of our vices only they make instruments to torture us. They bring us to ruin through what in us is good, gentle, humane, loving. But for my pity and affection for you, I would not now be weeping in this terrible place.